Welcome to In Gad We Trust, a podcast based in and around classic era golden age detective fiction of the 1920s to the 1940s. My name is Jim, I blog at The Invisible Event, and the plan for this podcast is that each episode features me in conversation with fellow bloggers, with authors, with enthusiasts in the genre, to talk about a topic of their choosing. Joining me for this episode is the translator of Japanese literature, Louise Heal Kawai. Louise, welcome to In Gad We Trust.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
You've been translating Japanese literature into English for quite a while now. Recent translations include 17 by Hideo Yokoyama, which was published by River Run Press. There was A Quiet Place by Saisho Matsumoto, published by Bitter Lemon Press. And possibly the titles that are going to be most familiar for listeners to this podcast are Soji Shimada's Murder in the Crooked House, yes, and Seishi Yokomizo's The Honjin Murders, that were both published by Pushkin Vertigo. That's quite a range of authors, quite a range of styles, a range of publishers. Could you just give us, to begin with, some idea of how you got started in translation in the first place?
Well, I first came to Japan to teach English as a foreign language, and I was working at a university, enjoying the teaching very much, but also really enjoying learning the language. I'd previously studied French and German and decided to challenge myself and add Japanese to that. And my university where I was working told me, well, if you want to stay on and have tenure, you have to have really good Japanese. So I decided to do a master's degree course, distance learning, from the University of Sheffield, actually. And I really enjoyed it. And I realized that the aspect of it I loved the most was reading the literature in Japanese and also the translations, particularly from Japanese into English rather than the other way around. And it just so happened that various life changes came about and I had to leave Japan and leave my job and move overseas for a short time. And the ideal thing to do when you're at home with a new baby, as I was, was to work from home. And translating Japanese literature was something that I decided to give a go. I tried a couple of kind of tests from different organizations or publishers, and I got offered work and not looked back. I have continued to translate Japanese literature ever since that. So it's been about 15 years now. It was hard at first. I didn't have any backup. I was in Fort Worth, Texas, of all strange places to be, to be translating Japanese, and there really wasn't a big Japanese community around me. And so it went very slowly. I also, as I just mentioned, had a new baby, and it went very, very slowly indeed. But practice, I won't say it makes perfect, but practice is important. And over the years, I got better and faster at it. And when I moved back to Japan, I had more opportunities and more help around me to support me with my translation. That's how I got started. It was all things that converged at one time to make me change careers.
So whereabouts in Japan are you based now?
I'm in Yokohama, quite close to Tokyo, although for the longest time I was in Nagoya, which is right in the center. Yeah, it's much better to be near Tokyo because I can go and meet publishers and go to lots of interesting literature-related events. So so much better than being in Nagoya, and way better than being in Fort Worth, Texas. And I apologize to anyone from Texas who's listening to this. I loved it there, but it just wasn't good for Japanese translation.
I imagine you probably were about 100% of the Japanese English translation community in Fort Worth, Texas, though, right?
Possibly so. Nice. I think that might be true.
Just picking up on this idea of where you're based now being better from a business perspective and from a publishing perspective. I'd just like to talk about how the actual commissioning of translated works, because I don't know if it's a question of you as a translator finding something that you think, oh, there should be an English translation of this, and putting together a pitch and taking that to a publisher to try to get interest in it, or whether it's more a case of a publisher deciding that they want to publish an English translation of a particular story, and so you being commissioned by them. Is it the first? Is it the second? Is it a combination of the two? How does that actually work?
It's very much a mixture of the two. Really does happen both ways. Personally, I would say that the majority of my work has been a British or American publisher purchases the rights to translate a novel from the Japanese publisher and the author, and then looks for a translator to translate it. And so most of the time, I haven't actually chosen what it is that I'm translating. Of course, I can choose not to accept, but I'm asked specifically to translate a work. However, over the years, I've also looked around and read things that I've been interested in and done samples and tried to pitch them. That doesn't work as well. Publishers usually have a strong idea of what they think will sell. And so they take some persuading to try their luck with something new. So that mostly if I want to have something published that I've just done out of my own interest, it's more likely that I would go to a literary magazine and pitch a short story. Okay. That would be more likely. To pitch a whole novel and have a publisher agree to finance it and publish it, that's a lot harder. Mm. It does happen, but it hasn't happened very often with me. Talking of literary magazines, there's something your listeners might be interested in. A Japanese literary magazine called treenovel.com is doing a flash fiction project right now with Japanese authors, many different authors of many different genres, and everybody's writing under 500 words in English. Of course, they're writing it in Japanese. They're writing a story related in some way to the coronavirus. And I'm lucky enough to be one of the translators involved in this project. I'm not the only one. There are many good translators on the project, but I have been able to translate short stories by some of the more well-known Shin Honkaku writers. Mm. I think you may have heard of Alice Arisugawa.
Yes.
And Takemaru Abiko.
Yes.
And Kanae Minato.
Yes.
They're three that you may have heard of. And of course, one that I had translated before, Soji Shimada.
Absolutely.
As well as a few others who are not crime fiction writers. I'll ask you, if you don't mind, to put the link to that site up for your listeners. And they may enjoy reading a little bit of how those writers would adjust their writing to deal with the topic of coronavirus.
And they're not necessarily crime stories. They're just authors who are currently perhaps best known for writing in the shinhonkaku genre. Is that fair?
That's correct. However, for example, Alice Arisugawa made his story about two of his most popular detective characters in an ongoing series that he writes. And it's how these two characters would interact in the days of COVID-19. Mm. It's very interesting.
That's great. Yeah, I'll put the link in the show notes below and people can check that out. Thank you.
Mm.
So, because they're obviously much shorter works, you say they're turning into about 500 words in English. Mm-hmm. That's obviously a very different experience to something 120,000 words, where you've got to keep a lot more in mind of tone, of pacing. How does that compare, doing something which is obviously designed to be so short in comparison to the much longer works that I presume have formed the majority of your translation experience to date?
Yes, it's been very challenging. First of all, I have to say, it's been challenging for the Japanese authors too. I told you I translated Soji Shimada's, and I'm actually personally friendly with Mr. Shimada. And he wrote to me that it was very hard for him to write an interesting story with only 1,000 Japanese characters, mm-hmm. as as the limit. And yes, it is hard to get any kind of development of character in such a short space, but it's been fun trying to do that. I was a little disappointed with what happened with my Takemaru Abiko story. He wrote an extremely shocking ending to his story, which I thought was very daring of him. And I really enjoyed translating it and wondered how everybody would react to the big sting in the tail of his story. But then somewhere along the line, somebody at Kodansha, the publishing company, must have said, hey, you know, this is a little too much. And the story got edited. And so I was very surprised to go online and find that the last paragraph of my translation had disappeared in a puff of smoke. But I don't really like when people feel they have to censor something, but I kind of understood in this case. It's still a little bit of a shocking ending. It just doesn't have quite as much of the power that it originally had. But it's a wonderful story. I really recommend it.
Well, they pretty much just cut out the last however many 20 words, let's say. It's just a clean cut. So your translation just finishes earlier than it did.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Okay.
If anybody wants to hear the real thing, get in touch with me.
I remember it's not quite the same thing. I remember there was an author a few years ago who wrote the ending to a particularly shocking chapter in one of their books that was not grammatically correct. And when the book went through the editorial process, somebody changed this sentence to be grammatically correct in a way that it landed with significantly less power. And she only found out when she got the final published copies of the book and was looking through it. And this sentence had been changed, and she was rightly furious. And I only know about it because she mentioned it on her blog, so I'm not breaking any private confidences by talking about this. And she got in touch with the publisher, and they were like, oh, no, we just thought it wasn't correct. And she's like, no, I wrote it like that because that's how it's supposed to be written. And my understanding is they reinstated her original version for the paperback release. So the hardcover and paperback releases are ever so slightly different. It's an interesting little Easter egg if anybody knows what the book is. Is there any chance that your original ending or that Abiko's original ending might be reinstated somewhere along the line, do you think?
Well, I actually found the author's account on Twitter and I wrote him a message, and he said that he had felt he ought to cut it because it reflected an actual incident that had happened in Britain, of all places. Okay. And he felt that, oh, I don't know how to explain this without giving away any spoilers, but he thought that it might not be appropriate the current climate for various reasons. So it won't be reinstated. But, you know, I kept a copy, and for a very short time, actually, they had forgotten to cut the English, even though they'd cut the original Japanese.
Oh.
They completely forgot to cut the English and the Chinese, actually. I forgot to say this is a trilingual story project. And they'd forgotten to cut both of the translations for a while. So for a short time, some people did see it in its entirety until they noticed and suddenly cut for the translations as well. But translators really hate when an editor goes and cuts something that we've done, just like authors do. Normally, they will send back any cuts or suggestions and we have to okay it before it goes to press. But just very occasionally, I've had the same experience as the author you just quoted, where I've opened a page of the book and gone, oh no, oh, how did that happen?
I just think it must be such a horrible feeling as well to find out like that. I think that must, because we are going to get into the amount of effort that goes into researching and the time that goes into ensuring that you get the details correct. And I think it must be awful to put in all of that time and, only find out once the book is out. I think it must be horrendous.
Yes, another anecdote about the same project, not Takemaru Abiko this time, but my Kanae Minato story. At the very, very last minute, apparently, the author made a few small additions to the text. And it was so late at night that they contacted the agent that I was working through, but the agent didn't see the email, and so they didn't get my corrections in time. So they decided to use Google Translate to add these corrections. And in this particular case, I opened the story and started reading, and something made absolutely no sense in English whatsoever. And I thought I was having something wrong with my brain, because I could not recall or imagine how I could possibly have written this. And I went on, and there were more. And I started to get a really creepy feeling, because the story came out at midnight every time. And so I was reading it sort of after midnight and possibly after a couple of glasses of wine. And I thought I was dreaming. And eventually I worked out what had happened, that these were additions rather than changes. And I got in touch with the editor eventually through the agent, but for 10 hours, that version of my really, which made me look like I couldn't actually speak English, was out. It was very upsetting, but it got fixed in the end and everything was cool.
There's quite a good Kafka-esque lockdown short story in that, isn't there? The translator who reads back their own translation.
And there are these extra bits.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
They never wrote.
Oh my God, did I write this? There's something nightmarish about that.
And worse, it's in bizarre Google Translate English, because Google Translate, however good it has become, and all other translation software has improved over the years, but
yeah,
it still does a terrible job with Japanese and English.
Yeah, I can believe. I mean, there are so many subtleties of meaning between languages anyway, but with Japanese and English, it must be even more, you know, several orders of magnitude more subtle, that are just going to cause so many difficulties. If you're a tiny bit out each time, you're really going to feel that over the course of, you know, even a sentence.
Yeah, it really does not work for literature at all, or for anything else, really. As I tell my students, I do teach English as well, and I tell my students, I can tell if you use Google Translate and you'll get a zero, so just don't even try.
Nice.
So then, a publisher comes to you with a novel, because it's likely to be a novel, as you say, and they want you to translate it. How much of your consideration and whether or not to accept that job is about recognizing, or the clarity of recognition of what that author's voice translated from Japanese sounds like in English? Because I imagine, and I could be way off here, but I imagine there's a certain consideration about, you don't want to get 4,000 or 5,000 words into a 90, 100, 120,000 word novel and be feeling that you're not doing the original Japanese voice of it justice. Is that something that you have to think about? Is that something which comes up in your consideration process? Because you've presumably now done so much Japanese translation that it might not be. I could be mile wide with this.
Now that I've had a lot of experience, I feel that I can read a Japanese author and get a good idea of how that person should sound in English, and probably wouldn't be put off by the idea that I might not have an image of how that person would sound. Perhaps at the beginning of my career, I wasn't as sure, but actually, no, I want to go back on that. I've actually always felt that I can hear a voice in English when I read a novel, and the voice is necessarily always different. What kind of book it is, what kind of writer they are, their age, their gender, it's always going to be different. And no matter who it is, I've read and had an image of how that person would sound. I'd be more likely to turn down a job simply because I was too busy and wouldn't be able to make the deadline, rather than thinking I don't like the idea of how this will sound in English.
Okay. And I suppose it's incredibly important then, if you have a sense of that voice, to maintain that consistently throughout the whole translated piece.
Absolutely. And if there's dialogue and different characters, to work out what each different character is going to sound like too.
So would I be right in assuming then that if you accept a commission to translate a novel, you will translate the entire novel before you then move on to translating anything else, so you're not trying to juggle different literary voices in your head?
Ideally, yes. But lately, I've been offered a few very interesting projects, and I don't really feel like turning any of them down. So I am actually going to try to translate two novels at the same time and see how that goes. I will have a morning novel and I'll have an evening novel, and we'll see how that goes. I'm also another part of my job. I do a lot of sample translations for Japanese publishers who need the samples to go to the Frankfurt Book Fair or the London Book Fair to try to persuade someone to buy it to translate it. And so I do a lot of work like that too. I'm doing a project where I'm translating theatre at the moment and couple of short stories and a couple of poems. So lately, I have been jumping around each day doing something different. I would never have done that earlier on in my career when I was learning the craft. I always did one novel, stopped, then another one. Hopefully, if I got one, there have been gaps in my CV, I can tell you. But nowadays, because I'm getting more well known, yeah, I've juggling lots of different things. It's kind of exciting.
So how do you actually go about the act of translating the novel from the Japanese? Do you sit at a desk with two computers in front of you, one with the original Japanese text and one with an open empty Word document, and you transfer it across like that? Do you sit with the novel in front of you in Japanese and you write it out longhand? What's your actual physical working space look like?
These days, more and more Japanese publishers are able to provide me with a PDF version of the novel, or I can get it on Kindle. I'm sorry, I don't like to push Kindle, but the great thing for a translator about using Kindle is that you can press on the screen on a kanji character that you don't know, and it will pop up with a translation or a reading of it,
Yes.
which is wonderful. So these days, yes, I often have two computers, one with the PDF on one screen and one with a Word document, exactly as you described. Sometimes I have the Kindle propped up on a little stand that I have. Sometimes when I have translated a very old novel or short story that there wasn't an online version of, or I was too green and didn't realize I was able to ask for one, I've actually had a paperback copy of it standing up in a stand and turning the pages as I went and typing. And sometimes those Japanese novels are really tiny little pocket versions. And my eyesight has got steadily worse since I started this job. I didn't have to use reading glasses at all when I started, so.
We were talking a little bit off mic before we started recording about how I was, probably still am, a very pretentious young man. And in my early 20s, I bought and read three different translations of Dante's The Divine Comedy. The first one I bought was translated by the American Mark Muser, and at the front of it, he wrote an 8 or 9 page translator's note that's always fascinated me. So I'd like to just read you a little bit from this on my way to asking a question about the act of translation. He's talking about the matter of diction and the choice of words, and he says, "Here, the translator must be absolutely faithful, choosing words and phrases that have the same tone as those of the poet. They must obviously suggest solemnity when he is solemn, lightness when he is light. They must be colloquial or formal as he is colloquial or formal. But most of all, the diction should be simple when Dante's is. And this is where the translators have sinned the most. There are two ways to sin against simplicity of diction. One concerns only the matter of word material and syntax, and a more subtle sin against the simplicity of Dante's diction is the creation of original, striking, rhetorical, or imaginistic effects where Dante has intended none." Now, given the degree of complexity involved in understanding, as you just said, even necessarily sometimes the meaning of the characters, because I know there's a huge kanji character alphabet, I'm interested in that idea of how you still retain the fidelity of something where there are so many shades of meaning in the language when it can be brought across a language barrier. And I wondered if that was something that you're able to talk about, to give those of us who don't have any idea what that's like and what the complexities involved in making those artistic decisions are.
One of the most difficult things about Japanese, apart from the fact that the writing style is completely different from English, with the use of kanji characters, which were imported from China, and hiragana characters, and katakana characters. So it actually has three styles of character. The hiragana and katakana are quite easy to learn. The Chinese characters, kanji, I don't think I'll ever learn them all in my lifetime. I don't think it's possible. So that's the obvious difference. It's grammatically, it's also extremely different from English. The sentence structures are completely different. I remember being absolutely, I'll use one of my favorite words, gobsmacked, when I discovered that the past tense can be held by an adjective. So instead of saying it was delicious, the literal meaning of what you say is it delicioused is. And I remember just having my mind blown by that. That was the start. That was the start of having my mind blown. My mind is still blown by this language. It's amazing. It's wonderful. Another thing that's incredibly difficult for a translator is that there are often no subjects or pronouns left in sentences, so that you're never quite sure who is being talked about and who is doing the speaking.
Okay.
You'll get piece of dialogue said, but you don't know who said it, because it's not necessary in Japanese to keep repeating who said something. And he, she, I, you exist, but they're not used very often. They're usually left out, so that you have to get a feeling, an idea from the style of the speech, who was speaking. And quite often a whole sentence, you can never quite tell if it's talking about a specific thing or if it's talking about an idea in general, because the subject is not clearly stated.
Okay.
Japanese is a strangely unclear language. And that is without doubt the most difficult thing. Not knowing a Chinese character when it comes up and you have to look it up in a dictionary, that's a bit of a pain, but it's very doable. Not having a clue what the subject of a sentence is horrendous, or can be horrendous. And you have to think, and you have to reread, and you have to consider. Sometimes I'll do a rough translation, and then I will have to go back later, and I've marked it, I've highlighted it, I've gone over it again. And quite often I'll suddenly have bright light moment. That's what it's talking about. Hooray. And I will then be able to translate it. Sometimes I just have to find a Japanese person to ask, please tell me what this sentence is about. But it happens less and less as time goes on. And I'm getting better at looking for those little hints that suggest who's talking, the style of the author as to who is probably the next speaker in the dialogue, etc. So, yeah, that's the most difficult thing about Japanese.
There are aspects of the way it is written which is obviously going to make that clear to a native Japanese speaker, and it is just this infinitely subtle game that you're trying to play. It's not as if even native Japanese speakers are reading books going, I've got literally no idea what this sentence is about. It is just that there is so much complexity inside of the language.
Yes. I mean, when I ask a Japanese person to help me, they don't grab it and say, oh yes, well, this is obviously so-and-so. They also go, Let me see. Well, yes, I think it's probably, it takes thought. It's deliberately written to in a style that makes you think.
It almost sounds like you're solving a cryptic crossword, right? Except that then somebody has to come back and interpret it as a piece of narrative without, I guess there's that inevitable amount of stop start in the translation, and you're trying to avoid that sense of it feeling as if it's been translated piecemeal along the way, aren't you?
Yes, well, I consider readability in English the most important thing. I really don't want a reader to pick up a book that I've translated and find it stilted and unnatural and think, oh, this doesn't sound like real English. This must be a translation. That's the most important thing. To be a good writer in English is actually a really important part of being a translator of literature. If you're not good at writing in your own language, you need not apply, if you like. So, assuming that a lot of your listeners will have read The Hanjin Murders, I'd like to use that as an example. As you know, it was published in 1946. And so, although it's not really old-fashioned Japanese as such, it was actually quite understandable. Obviously, the style of speaking is from another time, from golden age of detective fiction time, in fact. And I had in my head that it would be very, very important to have the narrator of the piece, who is a very important character. He's a narrator who claims to be a writer of detective fiction
That's right.
and claims to be telling us the story. He's a very self-aware narrator. And so I had in my head that he should sound like a character from detective fiction of that period. And so I had in my head the way that Sherlock Holmes sounds when he's talking, a little bit not Poirot because he is very Belgian, but I watched a lot of televised Sherlock Holmes episodes or other kinds of detective fiction from that period, listened to the way that they talked, and decided on that for my voice, as if it was Holmes, as if it was Holmes telling his story about his escapades with the interesting detective who would be Kindaichi Kosuke. Oh, sorry, English way around, Kosuke Kindaichi. That was very much in the back of my mind. Obviously, I didn't dwell on that too much because I didn't want to get in the way of the language. But I was very aware that I did not want this to sound like some 21st century narrator.
Yes.
That was what I decided, and I went from there. The characters in Japanese mostly spoke a very polite level of Japanese, despite the fact being family members. They were very sort of buttoned up characters trying to show to the world that they were important, a lot of self-importance. So I found in my head I had an image of each person being a little bit of a Agatha Christie character, maybe. Somebody in a country house who has a lot of money and is very sure of themselves. Just those ideas, those images in my head as a guidance as I'm translating. I didn't want to make the narrator Holmes, don't get me wrong, but just something to capture the right era, I suppose. But I'll tell you what else I did. Your listeners may be aware that Seishi Yokomizo is a huge name in Japan. It's almost unbelievable that he hasn't been translated before now. He is like Agatha Christie. He is like Arthur Conan Doyle. He's that well known. And his detective, Kosuke Kindaichi, is probably the most famous fictional detective ever in Japan. So, consequently, his books have been filmed or made into TV series so many times that I was actually able to watch a film of the Hanjin Murders before I translated it. So I had a physical idea of these characters. However, I just picked the one that was actually coming up on cable TV here, and they're doing a Kosuke Kinaichi special over this week. Oh, look, there's the Honjin Murders. I'll record it. So I recorded it and watched it, and although it gave me a very clear idea of the different characters, the director had completely changed the plot. And I hadn't actually read the book yet. I'd only just been asked if I'd like to translate it. So I hadn't actually read it yet. And I can't give anything away. There are going to be no spoilers in this. But shall we say, the criminal was not exactly the same as the book.
Okay.
That far different. And there was a huge subplot, where a very important character turned out to be someone completely different.
Mm.
And I thought this was the story. So then, talk about artistic license. So then I read the book and I kept thinking, well, that's funny. When is that person going to turn out to be... Yeah. You know what? Yeah. I'm sorry, can't give you any spoilers.
No.
And it became clear to me that I'd watched a very creative version of the novel.
If it's any consolation, there have been a series of adaptations of Agatha Christie's works in the UK in recent years, adapted by a lady called Sarah Phelps, that have caused a great amount of consternation among Agatha Christie fans because of the the liberties that she takes with aspects of plot, of character, of identities, of
killers. I mean, in fairness, so many of the Agatha Christie adaptations over the years have. There are stories that are not Miss Marple stories that have been made into elements of the Miss Marple TV series.
Right, right.
The Poirot stories add and remove characters and add and remove subplots. And so I think a lot of people will probably feel your pain having gone through that. It seems to be a fairly common treatment of these old detective stories.
Yes, but usually it's very handy because Yoko Mizo is so famous and because Kosuke Kindaichi is so famous, there are versions to be seen. So it's not common actually that I see a film version or a televised version of something I'm translating, but that turned out to be quite helpful.
Hmm.
Well, unhelpful in many ways,
right,
too. but yeah, that's good.
On the topic of screen adaptations, while they may not be entirely faithful to the story that they're translating, there's definitely an aspect of them where they can show things in a context which helps them make sense even if they are immediately unfamiliar. And I'm interested the extent to which, when something is written down, you as the translator have editorial control, shall we say, to provide additional guidance or additional explanation for things that are not necessarily going to be familiar. Because I'd imagine part of the challenge with something like the Honjin Murders is not only was it written practically 80 years ago, but also in taking it from Japanese into English, you're trying to cross a cultural barrier. And so there will be elements of things about Japanese culture from the 1940s, although, as you say, it is set earlier, but you know, there'll be elements of culture from the 1940s that are probably familiar to people in Japan in the 21st century that wouldn't be at all familiar to an English language audience in the 21st century. Golden Age detection is filled with this kind of stuff. And so I'm interested how much of this you had to confront. I mean, I, in the process of reading Golden Age detective fiction, have had to figure out endless things, like what a cork tip cigarette was, because it wasn't explained. It was just written at the time in the 20s and in the 30s. People knew what it was, and it took me probably about 10 years of reading to figure it out. I didn't know what a party telephone line was. There are countless examples like this. And that was written in English, in an English culture, by English authors, for English readers. So there's even less of a problem there with that translating. But what sort of difficulties did you face bringing old Japanese or older Japanese cultural elements into a modern 21st century book?
Well, there were masses of examples. Of course, the most important thing was the architecture, because the architecture is absolutely integral to the plot. If you don't understand what the house looked like, you cannot possibly understand why it was a locked room murder.
Yeah.
And in the end, understand the solution. So what I decided to do, luckily for me, I live in the age of the internet. If I had had to translate these books back before the internet, I think my life would have been harder.
I don't think I would have understood what a koto was. Let's talk about koto strings. I had to go and actually look it up to get a sense of what was meant just by that instrument.
Exactly. And there isn't a translation of the word koto.
No.
A koto is a koto. So I had to leave it as koto, but I was fully aware that readers who cared and wanted to know what that was would look it up on the internet and find what a koto looked like. So I was kind of lucky that way that the internet is available. However, when you read, you get into a book, you want to keep reading, you get absorbed in a book. And I really imagined the readers getting so deeply into the book that anything that made them break and think, oh, hang on, what's that, would be too much of a distraction. I know it's not, wasn't possible to completely avoid that, but I wanted to do my best. Mm. And one of the things I always avoid is using footnotes. Some people, especially in academic texts or nonfiction, will go the footnote route. Mm. You'll have a little mark in the bottom of the page or at the end of the chapter, an explanation of what something is. I don't want to do that. I don't want the reader to have to keep stop and look at footnotes. So what I tried to do was use the Japanese word for something. Let's use, for example, a ranma, R-A-N-M-A in Roman lettering. I put that in and I put its translation as transom. But in fact, if you look up a transom, it's not exactly the same thing, because Western architecture and Japanese architecture are completely different. So what I would do was put the word ranma in so people would have a chance to look it up, describe in as much detail as I could what this particular one looked like, call it a transom sometimes so that the reader would not keep thinking, hang on a minute, what was a ranma again? But then every so often drop the word ranma back in again to remind them that it was this Japanese thing and not a transom window as we see in the West. Mm. And so it was a subtle game, if you like, that I was playing. How often to say ranma, how often to say transom. When it was the sliding paper doors, which are called shoji, how often to say shoji, how often to say paper doors. Mm. How often to say shoji paper doors, shoji doors. You know, how often to mix the original Japanese, albeit written in Roman lettering, and the meaning. And I was absolutely terrified once this book had gone to print, because I get a lot of reviews, usually very nice reviews in blogs and such as yours, and newspapers, but often a lot of quick reviews on places like Amazon and Goodreads. Mm. And a frequent complaint is, oh, this must have been lost in translation because I couldn't follow what the room looked like, or the worst one is I couldn't follow all the characters' names, etc., etc. So I was terrified. Had I put enough of the Japanese word in, enough of the explanation of it in, for the reader to enjoy the book but still be able to follow what was going on, because this is a very complicated setup. I also did a lot of physical research on this. I went to visit old houses in parks around Japan to have a look at how this might work and how it might be set up. And I was able to get in my head a picture of what some of the things looked like that I hadn't quite got. For example, there's talk of bamboo supporting the lower heavy branches of pine trees.
Mm.
So I went to a Japanese garden and had a look what those actually looked like, because I had to have in my head what it looked like in order to be able to explain it clearly for the reader. Another thing, excuse me, just going off on this story, but this is one that I like. There was one word I was having a lot of trouble with. It was the word kozaru, and it clearly meant a kind of lock, and it was the lock that had locked the rain shutter doors closed. And I asked lots of Japanese people, what is this? Because I couldn't find it in a dictionary. And the funniest thing is that kozaru literally means small monkey. And so when you typed it into Google, guess what you got? Lots and lots of pictures of small monkeys. And obviously this was not what it meant. And then occasionally I'd find another thing, and it was something to do with an old-fashioned charcoal brazier kind of thing. But it clearly wasn't that either, because it was obviously from the context, the lock on the door. And so I asked so many people, nobody seemed to know what it meant. It was obviously a word that had gone completely out of usage.
Yeah.
So I ended up going to this sort of open air museum place that had old buildings from all over Japan that had been moved for display. And I asked the guide, do you know what a kozaru is? And he didn't know either. And I was beginning to tear my hair out. And then he said, but if you like, we do have a meeting here today over in the main building, and we have a specialist who happens to be here. I was like, yes, yes. And the nice man came out of his meeting and knew exactly what a kozaru type lock was, and showed me, drew a picture for me, explained how it worked. And I was so happy. So I kind of want your readers to know that translators don't always deal only with the language. We deal so much with research, so much with learning stuff, finding stuff out, going places. The internet, thank goodness, I keep saying this, thank goodness I translate in the age of the internet, but being able to look things up online. I translated a completely different novel that was set up in the mountains of Gunma Prefecture in Japan. And there were so many names of mountains and mountain passes and bits of mountains and paths to mountains. And I had to look up whether these were already translated into English somewhere and had an accepted English translation, or whether they'd never been translated into English before. And if so, how was I going to translate them, or was I going to leave them in Japanese? There were probably several hundred decisions within this one book. That was a different book. I'm not talking about the Honjin murders. No, that was 17 by Hideo Yokoyama. Wonderful book, but took me forever to do the research. But anyway, we take a lot of pride in our work, we translators. We want to get everything right, so we spend a lot of time on research. And I'm very happy to say I was able to say whether the lock on the door should be flipped open, slid open, turned, or whatever. That's why I needed to know, because I had to have the right verb.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
On the subject of trying to make things as clear as possible, the ending of this is a phenomenally technical piece of explanation, probably one of the most technical I think I've ever encountered. And it's helped by the fact that there is a map of the annex in which the murders take place. Was there ever a discussion about trying to provide another larger map to show the overall relative geography of the family home? Because what is around the annex also comes into play sometimes. I wondered if that...
Yes, I would have loved there to be a map. What we have in the book is Yokomizo's original sketch, and it's a very simple one, but it doesn't show how that fits in with the rest of the family compound, the other buildings in the compound, where the river flows, where the mountains are, where the road is, and even where that part of the village fits in with the rest of the village.
Mm.
That's all described very clearly in the book. you walked past this. When we first meet the detective Kindaichi, he's walking from the station past a certain place, etc. You have to hold all that in your head. And I thought it would be nice to have a map, but there's various reasons why publishers can't do that. I mean, somebody has to be found to draw it. Mm. And believe me, my drawing skills were not up to it, would never be up to that. So yes, that idea was turned down. However, I did succeed with this book and actually other books that I've translated in getting a character list included.
Oh,
they're
so that
not
wasn't
in the original.
Okay.
No. These were made by me.
Mm.
I decided, with complete backing of the publisher too, that listing all the characters, the dramatis personae, and who they are, what their relationship with other people is very useful, because Japanese names are not familiar to the average English reader, and some of them sound very similar. I mean, we found this earlier today because the three writers we were talking about have the names Seishi, Seicho, and Soji. If I read those three names in a book, I'd get mixed up which one was which. I wouldn't be sure, you know, and I do speak Japanese. So I think a character list with a basic description of who they are and how they fit into the family or whatever is very important. And that is generally something that most publishers will agree to.
That's cool. That's cool.
The two terms that I think have become increasingly well known, certainly in the English speaking world in recent years, are honkaku and shin honkaku, when we're talking about the sort of styles of plotting and writing that Yoko Mizo certainly employed. And I imagine it's very similar with the orthodox style and then this new orthodox style. I imagine it's very similar to what we saw in the English language genre in the end of the 1940s, where you had a very puzzle-dense, very plot-heavy period of writing in the detective novel. And we go back and we talk about the queens of crime being the likes of Agatha Christie and Dorothy L. Sayers. And then in the 1950s, there became more of a move towards psychological suspense, towards domestic suspense, and your queens of crime in that instance became the likes of Margaret Millar and Patricia Highsmith and various others. At this point, we do start to move out of my area of expertise. Is it fair to say, I get this purely from honkaku being seen as one period and shin honkaku being seen as another, is it fair to say that honkaku went through this same falling out of fashion in Japan, and that Yoko Mizo's style of writing and plotting fell out of fashion in the same sort of way?
Yes, I think so. Although Yoko Mizo was very, very popular for a long time, and his character, particularly Kindaichi Kosuke, was incredibly popular and still is to this day. But along came, particularly one I'll mention, is Seicho Matsumoto, who became another complete god of Japanese crime fiction, as Yoko Mizo was. And he was more the psychological mystery, the social, talking about social conditions and looking about how those would influence a character's behavior. And he started to become very popular in the 50s.
Yes.
And Yoko Mizo was still writing, but I think eventually by about the 70s, Matsumoto had taken over as being the king of crime fiction, the most read author, and the traditional or orthodox puzzle-based mysteries were not quite as popular. And coincidentally, Yoko Mizo died in 1981, and that's the same year that Soji Shimada published his Tokyo Zodiac Murders and was one of the creators of the Shin Honkaku, which of course, as you mentioned earlier, literally means new orthodox. That's also been very popular. And so since the 80s, there's been this big resurgence. Since Yoko Mizo passed away, there's been this great resurgence of that style of mystery known as the Shin Honkaku movement.
Mm. Yes. There is that extended parallel then with Christie and Yoko Mizo almost, isn't there? Because they are both hugely popular, seen as the absolute pinnacle of their genre, create these detectives that live for decades and decades and decades of extreme popularity and have survived their creators in terms of how well culturally they're known. And as their careers wore on, they certainly remained incredibly popular, but the fashions of the style of writing, interestingly, around the same time as well, if we're looking at Matsumoto coming in the 1950s, which, yes, as I say, when Highsmith and Miller and that started writing. It's just interesting to consider those parallels are so marked. I mean, obviously Christie started writing sooner, but we know there was that chapter in Honjin Murders where effectively they just go through a bookshelf which is full of detective fiction authors. And so we know that we imply from this that Yoko Miso was incredibly highly influenced by a lot of Western detective fiction from the Golden Age.
Didn't hide it, did he?
No, I think that's wonderful. I mean, that's something that you see a lot in Golden Age detective fiction. You know, a lot of people in their own novels from the 30s and 40s are writing about the authors, or, you know, make a mention of the authors who were hugely influential on them. I think it's a lovely tradition to carry on over that cultural divide.
Yes, and incidentally, just in case this is interesting to your listeners, Yoko Miso was writing before the Second World War as well, but a lot of his stuff was not deemed suitable. Mm-hmm. Because it was too Western and the West was becoming the enemy. And particularly during the Second World War, he wasn't able to publish anything at all. So you'll see that the Honjin Murders is set in 1937.
Yes.
And one suspects he might even have started writing it around that time. I don't know. I have absolutely nothing to back up that assertion.
No.
But it was not published until 1946, i.e. the war was over and it was okay to publish Western-based things that paid homage to Western authors, etc.
So what's happened to all of that pre-war writing? Is it apocryphal? Do we know it definitely exists? It simply hasn't been translated. Has it since been translated in the light of his huge popularity? What happened to it?
Well, no. There have only been two works by Yoko Miso Seishi translated so far, and that's the one I translated, The Honjin Murders, and The Inugami Clan, which is now being reissued as The Inugami Curse, both by Pushkin Vertigo.
Yes.
So, you know, nothing else has been translated yet, I should say.
So what we need to do then for all this early stuff is we need to get Tony Medawar from last week. Once he's done finding work by English authors that has been forgotten and lost, we need to get him over to Japan so that he can start digging through all the stuff from the Honkaku authors that's forgotten and lost. Is this right?
Maybe so. He had one novel published pre-war, but it got very heavily edited by the authorities. Well, we should say censored, really. And as I say, during Second World War, he was unable to publish anything because everything was considered too Western. After the Second World War, he had more luck, and the Honjin Murders and other books were published as in serial form in journals or newspapers, which is very, very common in Japan for many years. Seicho Matsumoto would do the same thing. Mm. And then later, the serial was collected together and put into novel form.
Again, the same thing happened over here with, I mean, I know certainly some of Agatha Christie's novels were published in serial form as well. I love these parallels. I love this idea that the same style of puzzle plotting has occurred over there, that the same rise and fall in fashion in what is popular in detective fiction occurred at pretty much the same time, that you have the serializations of these novels by these hugely popular authors at the same sort of time. I love this. This is really, really cool. I love all these parallels between the two.
One final thing then. I don't know if you can talk about this. You might be required to keep your own counsel to preserve an air of secrecy. Can I ask if you have any more translations in the pipeline? Can we expect anything else?
Yes. What can I say? I cannot be completely open about this, but I will be involved in translating more crime fiction. And I'm absolutely sure that there will be something that your listeners will be very interested in coming up. But I am unfortunately unable to tell you exactly what that is.
Okay. Well, I think it's nice to tease people so they, you know, they don't know exactly what they're getting. It keeps them on their toes. They'll get complacent otherwise. So I think that's perfect. Louise, thank you for this. I've really, really enjoyed being able to pick through this. It is fascinating to hear about something which is, I think, is so easy to take for granted. And I think it must be tremendously rewarding to see something of this complexity through to completion. And I really, really appreciate the work you're doing on these translations and all the research that goes into it. So thank you for that. And thank you for taking the time to talk to me today and to be so open and so wide-ranging in what we've had the chance to discuss.
You're very welcome. In fact, I must thank you because, to be honest, translators do get overlooked a lot. You'd be surprised how many reviews of books that are translated come out without mentioning the translator's name at all. You'd almost think that perhaps the writer had written them in English and that no one else was involved, if you go by some of the reviews you see. People don't seem to know that a translator takes a book, reads it, and then rewrites the whole thing, albeit staying as true to the original as possible, but putting it in their own readable, hopefully, English. And I consider myself a writer just as much as a translator. And so it does hurt sometimes that translators get overlooked, or worse, get blamed if somebody doesn't like the book. Oh, it must have been a poor translation. But so it means a lot to me that you felt that you would like to hear more. And I've been absolutely thrilled to be here and love talking about my job, my work, my art, whatever you like to call it.
Oh,
Thank you
amazing.
so much.
I think it's definitely all three. Look, I would love to do this again sometime if we've got stuff that's of interest to this audience. I can confidently say people would love to hear more about this in due course. So if there's a chance to do this again, I would love to do this again.
Great. I'd love to be here again.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Have a lovely day.
Thank you. You too.